Good morning. Back in the sweet spot, it's Jays Talk Plus talking about an anemic Blue Jays offense that didn't hit with runners in scoring position or in the first inning or at all. What a bad one. They lose 2-0 to the Texas Rangers. They will try to settle the series today with Paxton Schultz on the mound against Smoke and Mirrors. Tyler Mahle will set that one up for you throughout the course of the show, but we have a bad game to break down. We'll do it ourselves here. We'll do it with Jonah Bierenbaum at 11 o'clock as well. We also have Rowan Kavner and Paul Hempikidis on the show a little later today. We'll sprinkle in some of your leftover texts from yesterday as well to try to not lift the mood, because all the text line questions are always negative, as they should be right now. Here is the... Oh, there's a positive from the game. By the way, this is Blake Murphy, Julia Kreutz alongside me. This is how you know I'm grumpy, when I don't pass the baton for the first 60 seconds.
I like it when you go on a little bit of a rant, Blake. It gives me a chance to sort of gather my thoughts and, you know, calibrate my energy. Okay, if this is what Blake is bringing today, then dang it, I got to be more positive. All right, well, tell me your positive then.
Yeah, well, we'll get into the positive that was Bowden Francis, who had his probably best outing of the season so far, if not for sure, then certainly in his last couple starts.
Absolutely.
Perhaps
the best of the season.
We'll dig in a little bit. This is a Texas Rangers positive, and I am pretty staunchly anti-capitalist in general, but I have a deep appreciation for innovation in terms of how we advertise in sports. And, you know, in NBA, we get the digital ads on the court where, like, someone's mom will ask me, are those real? Like, and it's like, no, like, they're on that. That's why they glitch out and they're on top of the players sometimes. You know, UFC and WWE have ads all over the ring and the ring posts and stuff like that now. And maybe this has always been there and I just didn't notice it until yesterday. The Texas Rangers have sold ad space on the foul poles.
Oh, yeah. I think there's a few. I know that the Astros, they're a lot for the postseason. So at the Astros ballpark, which is not called Minute Maid Park anymore, they have a Chick-fil-A.
That's what Texas has as well.
Oh, cool. So maybe it's a Texas thing. I don't know. I particularly like the TV ads on the mound. I think that's like a neat way to sneak something in there.
Stop trying to sell me fat loss injections. I'm trying, Jennifer, but not with injections. Please stop. I don't know. The foul pole, it's very like basketball to me. If you've ever, that you don't seem like you've watched basketball.
I thought maybe you had just mispronounced the word there.
No, it's the creators of South Park have a movie called Basketball from back in the day where they invent a new sport. And the way the sport picks up, it starts to like all the most convoluted things that fans hate about, you know, the other major sports is like they like hyper focus on those. So there's, you know, lots of ads everywhere. The tournament format is so complicated that there's a giant board and no one can figure it out and things like that.
Oh, that sounds fun for us sports reporters.
Yeah, it would be. It's a great movie.
Okay.
I shouldn't say that because it's 2025 and I have no idea if it would hold up remotely appropriately now. But it was, I really enjoyed it in high school is what I will say. What I didn't enjoy was the Toronto Blue Jays putting up another goose egg, squandering that good Bowden Francis start.
It was an entertaining game, Blake. We just couldn't get anything done, or the Blue Jays couldn't get anything done offensively. But I will say that, you know, the times in which they did, you know, string something together, it looked like they had legitimate chances and, you know, expected batting averages in certain balls and just how many hard hit balls that they had. It all looks like it was trending in the right direction, but that has been a bit of an issue, right? It's you're hitting balls hard, whatever. It doesn't seem to matter. And at this point, we are all, I think, getting tired of talking about process or whatever it is. I will say there needs to be a little bit of credit given to the Rangers pitching staff. I know that Nathan Eovaldi only went two innings, but what the relievers did was a pretty good job. They made some big pitches when they had to, basically painting their way out of trouble there. Still, the Blue Jays offense is very much to be held responsible. I just think that it's also, you know, fair to say that they made some big pitches when they needed them.
Sure. But like if Jacob Latz and Sean Armstrong, and no disrespect to those guys, they're major league pitchers, go 4 2/3 shutout and dance around you. Like imagine the opposite situation where Chris Bassett gets hooked after two innings and the Blue Jays get 5 shutout innings out of Mason Fluharty and Braden Fisher. We would sit here on the show and we would be, hey, great appearances from those guys. Let's break it down a little bit. We'd also be doing backflips that they managed to get through five inning shutout against even a bad offense. Like, cool. Jacob Latz, good for you. Four strikeouts. You know, that's a guy with a double-digit walk rate who is the last guy in the bullpen and is a mop-up situation kind of guy like this. Sean Armstrong is like exactly the type of guy who would bother the Blue Jays if he was like an opener or something like that. Maybe he just has such a razy name that I'm just... also, an aside, Armstrong is the best name you could have as a pitcher.
As a pitcher, yeah. It is.
Other than when there was Outman.
Oh,
that's an
love
even better
that.
One. Yeah,
better even for a reliever, I'd say that's a good one. Yeah, Sean Armstrong, Blue Jays. I've seen a lot of him. Obviously,
yeah.
He played a long time for the Tampa Bay Rays.
Yeah,
tough guy to figure out. I guess
so,
I don't know.
Anyway,
he shouldn't be, but here we are.
I understand what you're saying. Latz and Armstrong and Milner and Robert Garcia. I thought Luke Jackson was really bad. Mm. I thought he got away with a lot in his eighth inning there. Like, you can tip your cap to those guys, but we went through a big chunk of this season already where we did the starters they're facing are so difficult, and look at this run of opposing pitchers they're on. You can, but like the Blue Jays can't feel good about the last time we went 10 games without scoring very many runs, it was because we faced all these starters, and then turn around and be like, well, Jacob Latz got us. You gotta tip your cap. And again, it's not about Jacob Latz specifically. It's about the Rangers. We came in, I believe the Rangers were fourth in starter ERA and like 18th in reliever ERA entering this series. This is absolute best case scenario for the Blue Jays offense is to get Eovaldi out of there. Eovaldi, who's been one of the best starters in baseball all year, didn't have his command and control early. And I think that was related probably to the triceps fatigue or tricep soreness that they took him out as a precaution. But yeah, even if those relievers made good pitches and things like that, this was a dream scenario for the Blue Jays. And not even in the series finale, earlier in the series, where if you could have got the lats, if you could have got the Armstrong, eat into all those arms and then it bleeds into today. Instead, you get, you know, five innings of clearance from Lats and Armstrong and one out from Milner, who had pitched a bunch the day prior. He came in to get Varsho in the lefty-lefty situation to end the seventh there. So, yeah, I don't feel too badly for the Blue Jays about the other guys doing
and
a good job
listen,
executing.
You can't have the leadoff man reach base as many times as the Blue Jays did and come up empty as many times as the Blue Jays. There is no excuse for that.
Let's talk about it.
Yep.
The first inning, leadoff double. Awesome. Mm-hmm.
Bo Bichette is back. There you go. The underlying numbers made sense.
Even Vlad has a typical, that ball's out of 4 out of 30 ballparks. Mm-hmm. Look at how hard he hits it. At least it moves the runner up the third.
Yeah.
Nothing. Second inning, George Springer, leadoff double. Great.
Fantastic.
George Springer's back. He's on second. You've got another one there. In that case, Anthony Santander even walks behind him. So you get two on. Absolutely nothing. Through the first two innings, they're 0-for-6 with runners in scoring position.
That, to me, is the most absurd thing, right? Yeah. It was two innings, and you're 0-for-6 already.
With three shots at it each time. So they finished the game 0-for-10 with runners in scoring position with 11 batters stranded. And get this, so they are now in a stretch of 3-for-36 with runners in scoring position. None of those three hits scored a run. The only runs they've scored with runners in scoring position were the ground into double play with the bases loaded and a sac fly, which is, of course, not a hit. They have stranded 63 runners in their last 64 innings over the course of the last seven games. And that includes a game where they actually won in extra innings. They just stranded so many guys in that extra inning game. The Padres finale had no business going to extra innings.
Yeah.
So 63 stranded runners in the last 64 innings. If you're curious, by the way, league average about 6.5 stranded a game. So if you're at 9 per game, that's on the high end. Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. Even 6.5 was like... I was like, huh, so an average baseball game, you're pretty frustrated with the execution with runners on base. The Jays, league-wide, the league hits .249 with runners in scoring position. That's exactly where the Jays are, but they are 50 points below league average in terms of slug with runners in scoring position. So yesterday it was more about the batting average. They couldn't come through, you know, the 3-for-36 stretch. In general, though, it's been, again, the inability to do lots of damage when you start building a big inning. You get a leadoff double two innings in a row against a pitcher who clearly can't find his location, even though he's a control artist, and you come away empty with that. There was also the fifth, seventh, and eighth.
Yeah,
where
I was gonna say,
multiple runners got stranded.
There were three more occasions there in which the Blue Jays could have gotten something done. And like you said, Blake, this bullpen is not a top bullpen in the league by any means, the Rangers. And so, you know, just watching the way the things went, and we have spoken about this before. It's the quality of at bat, right? There were some good at bats sprinkled in there, and again, the Blue Jays had their chances. They did run into a little bit of bad luck, but there were some ugly swings that really had no business, you know, balls that had no business being swung at it. And that has also been an issue for the Jays. So for as much talk about process as we have done, it's tough to sort of quantify that. And if the results don't start showing up, then guys are going to press regardless of what's happening.
But like, I feel like our discussions about process have also been attempting to diagnose this, which
right.
is how do you hit the ball so hard? How do you get a good average? How do you get leadoff hitters? Here's a confounding stat. They're hitting 282 in the first inning. They're one of the very best teams in the league for getting guys, getting hits in the first inning.
Yep.
And then they are minus 28 in first inning run differential. And it's like some of that is just like, again, the no slug. They only have four first inning home runs. Only Houston and Kansas City have fewer. But like there are so many curiosities where they're a top 10 team in hard hit balls. They are very good at batting average in the first inning and they can't score runs. There are just so many little curiosities like that. So I feel like when we do talk about process, yeah. I have some interesting notes on their hard hit ball stuff. And like for me, the process has shifted from 2023 was the, we got to talk about swing decisions and you got to cut down the chase and cut down the whiff and stuff like that. They're good at that.
Yep.
They have the lowest strikeout rate in the league. I'm not worried about that. What this is, and then last year was a little bit more of, well, you got to hit the ball hard too. You can't just swing at the right pitches. And now they're hitting the ball hard and they're swinging at the right pitches and they're still not getting results. So that's where this is. If it were any other team,
yeah.
I would find them fascinating. I would also find going 3-for-36 with runners in scoring position over five games
terrible.
And your only run getting scored by a double play, I would find it really funny if it weren't the Jays. If the Mets had done this or the Red Sox had done this, I would be having a blast poking at it. But it is like the process side is, you know, you never get there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, we went through the swing decisions era. We went through the... Now you got to hit it hard also here. Now you're doing all that stuff and you're still not getting results. So I still find the process side fascinating because there is still a giant question of what's missing. Where is the disconnect between the stuff that you are trying to accomplish process-wise and the results that aren't coming?
So in the way that you sort of look at it and, you know, the stat digging that you do or when you're watching the game or whatever it is, obviously... You know, if we had an answer, we wouldn't be here. We would be working for a team and making lots of more money. But what have you found, I guess, that somewhat explains this difference between process and execution?
Yeah, nothing that, like, there's no smoking gun of, you know, Vlad's ground ball rate is too high.
Right.
Vlad does have some instance to do that. But actually, this is relevant to our conversation with Ben Clemens yesterday. But what we can do with some of this new bat tracking stuff
mm-hmm.
is... And I'm not the most well-versed in it yet. I'm not a, you know, Joe Siddle could tell you better about, you know, what swing tilt actually looks like and how the execution of it goes. But when we dig in on those numbers, we see that a lot of the Blue Jays hard hit balls are not actually on the ground necessarily. They're league average in ground ball rate. They're league average in pulling the ball in the air. So some of the indicators that we would have looked at with Vlad in the past or some other guys. But one thing that they are... quote unquote top of the league in is when they do hit the ball, it's with a very flat bat path.
A lot of and liners.
Yes. Right so on. When you think about what a flat bat path would do when it connects with the ball, you're probably a little bit behind it because if you know, the early part of your swing is the upswing part of the swing, and then you're probably not hitting the ball super high mm-hmm. in the air. You're doing it more line drives. What's really good for batting average? Hitting a lot of hard hit line drives. Luis Arraez doesn't hit the ball hard, but Stephen Kwan, for example,
yep.
high batting average because it's all on the line. It's going to go 200 feet and drop right in front of the right fielder every time. It's not going to go over the fence a ton. So the way the Jays swing on average, and Vlad's the best example of this because we've talked about for years, you know, why does Vlad hit the ball so hard and why doesn't it leave?
Yeah. Things like that. Yes.
Yeah, and like we can look at, you know, Robert Orr of Baseball Prospectus has damage rate, which kind of takes all those things into account in each individual thing. So you don't get a lot of credit for hitting 115 into the ground. You
right.
get more credit for hitting 100 with good lift because that'll do more damage on average. So we can look at that kind of stuff. And I think Vlad's a great example because intuitively, what would frustrate you watching Vlad, who is a very good player who doesn't get into his power as often as you might like, is, yeah, it's a lot of warning track stuff. It's a lot of stuff hit really hard and it dies at the center fielder, or it would have been out of some parks, but not out of this park. And then you dig in, and Vlad is a guy that when he hits the ball, very flat bat path at the point of attack or the point that he's making contact. And that's true basically for every non-Varsho, non-Springer Blue Jay. It's a team full of guys with really flat bat paths, especially when they get into their kind of A swings. And so that's where I'm at process-wise, is there is the disconnect here seems to be the way in which they're generating the hard contact. Now, maybe that means you need to cheat just a little bit more, be a little bit more out front, get a little pull into it, get a little loft into it. I'm not sure. There might be a trade-off where then you're not making enough contact. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about early in the year, and this was more before we even had shows, but, you know, George Springer's success, yes, early on, was he quote-unquote cheating a little bit? Was he jumping out so that he could get the fastball? If he's guessing spin early, he might have a really bad swing and miss if it's 97 and he was guessing spin, or vice versa. But if he guesses right, he's all over it. He's getting it in the air. He's getting it in the air hard. And then, like we talked about at length yesterday, Dalton Varsho, a guy with some holes in the swing right now, a lot of swing and miss, a lot of chase right now. But when he does connect, who's had the absolute best contact on the Blue Jays so far? It's been Dalton Varsho. So it's not... Every hitter's different. We can't sit here and be like, Vlad and Bo and Barger and Clement should all add more loft to their swing and accept more swing and miss or whatever. But as a team, that's where the issue is that all of your best contact is flat, and that's good for average, but it tends to do much less damage.
That's a fascinating analysis. And you did mention Dalton Varsho a bunch there. Varsho is a guy who... Entering spring training, he actually needed to force himself to quote-unquote swing down because he put the ball in the air so much, and that led to a lot of, you know, very high fly balls, balls that didn't necessarily get to where he wanted to go. But, yeah, he's putting the ball in the air. That's great. He found a middle term, it seems like, a middle ground for himself the other way around, and that came, as he spoke about in spring training, by... You know, feeling like he is swinging down too much. And that's okay. He's slowing himself down and he's still putting the ball in the air to a more effective degree. George Springer, another great example. And yes, he won't say it out loud to us, but yeah, he did make that trade-off very clearly. He is swinging and missing more and getting his A swing in.
And we're seeing him pay the freight for it a little bit the last 2 weeks. We'll talk a little bit more about what's going on with George Springer with Jonah Bierenbaum, because Jonah's got some stuff he's going to bring with us. He had a really good video feature when Springer was killing it.
Yes.
And he's a little cold now, although the double yesterday was nice to see. But yeah, I think it's just, anyway, I hope I did an okay job explaining those kind of bat metric stuff.
Yeah.
And I know it's more of a visual thing, but hopefully everyone can kind of understand what I mean with the flat bat path and things like that. And this is not a smoking gun. It's not a, aha, David Popkins needs to fix this. It's just, as you dig around for answers, this is the best thing that I can come up with at this point of how you end up with, over a 3.5 week span, more 100-mile-an-hour outs than any team in baseball.
And listen, Varsho's changes didn't happen overnight. Springer's changes didn't happen overnight. It is not as simple as let's tweak the mechanics. There's a lot that goes into a swing, especially when you're talking about a guy like Bo Bichette who has a million moving parts to his swing, right? So it should be simple. It is not. So I understand when the Blue Jays talk about patience. I understand when they talk about just sticking with what they're doing and, you know, finding solace in their teammates and things like that. But it is May 28th, and this team wants to make the playoffs. And so something needs to happen to sort of correct a little bit of what you're talking about here, Blake.
I can't wait to find out what the next layer of this is. And I'm oversimplifying, but 2023 is the year we're talking about better swing decisions. 2024 is the year we're talking about you got to hit the ball hard. Now 2025 is you've made the right swing decision. You got to hit the ball hard. Now you have to hit the ball hard right. I'm fascinated next year when they have like perfect launch, like perfect attack angles and things like that, what the new thing is.
And they're still scoring just 2 runs a year.
What the new thing is, because as Jonah Bierenbaum, who will join us later, tweeted out this morning, this is the worst 5-game stretch of run scoring for the franchise since 1990. So I thought we were done with all the Blake made up a new stat and dug around in stat head queries and stuff like that for new stuff. But we're so back.
We're so back, and I'm so glad we're here. I'm always seated for your stats, whether they're good or bad. It's tough that they've been mostly bad, Blake, but I trust the better days are ahead of us.
Yes. Speaking of, actually, let's save some of the Bowden France stuff, because we're going to go deep on it with Jonah Bierenbaum. He obviously had a good outing, but two more notes on the position player side. Vlad now has a career-long 27-game on-base streak, and just to kind of hammer home what we're talking about, and again, Vlad's the star of the team, so it's not to pick on him, because he has been an above-average hitter. Over that 27 games, he's been about 35% better than a league-average hitter. However, 27-game on-base streak, 7 extra base hits, and you're slugging .433. Yeah. Kind of a good snapshot of where the team is at. If you believe head of the snake, you know, or the old, when I wrestled in high school, where the head goes, the body goes. If that's what Vlad is, a lot of on base, a lot of batting average, and not a lot of slug, that's of interest. The other thing of interest is we had a great chat with Dan Schulman on Monday's show, and we all were kind of in agreement that we'd see Jonathan Clase a little bit more to try to give it a different look. And then he's been down for 2 days in a row. One, I maybe understood, maybe it's a bit of a punishment for the pickoff. You've got 3 lefty starters coming up in this Athletic series, so maybe you're trying to get other guys reps knowing that they'll be down for days. But was pretty fascinated to see him out of the lineup 2 days in a row, given what we saw on the weekend and given what our conversation with Dan was like.
Listen, if it was, and we don't know, but if it was, you know, if one of those days in which he didn't start was a punishment for getting picked off, I'm sorry, I can never agree with that.
Also, like half the team should be. You wouldn't have 9 players in the lineup.
Yeah, well, Bo Bichette would be sitting more often than not.
Nathan Lucas didn't play yesterday, but he'd be in. Although they said Mark Budzinski was, you know, more. But Lucas has had a couple this year as well.
But if that is the case, then I'm sorry, I cannot agree with that, especially when it comes to a young player. And yeah. I agree with you. He should be playing more. Dan went as far as saying that maybe they should put him in between Bo and Vladdy in the lineup to try to separate those two and make some, you know, better things happen, I guess.
I forget who, so I apologize to them, but someone asked in the text line yesterday as well, what about Class A getting a look in the leadoff spot? I mean, that's where people are at in terms of where the lineup is and where his, you know, I don't think he's going to hit .330, but like the on-base potential, working good at bats and having a little bit of a speed element, because you're back toward the bottom of the league in stolen bases and things like that. And that's partially Andrés Giménez being out, but generate something a little bit. Anything. So I was pretty surprised to see him out of there 2 days in a row. Again, three of the next 5 starters they're going to face are lefties, so there should be Class A opportunities, but interesting anyway.
This may also be a roster configuration type of deal. If you want to give Bo Bichette a DH day, give him a day off his feet, then you kind of, you know, take away that possibility, and so you have to play Anthony Santander and George.
Funny outfield yesterday.
Yeah, it's Dalton Varsho. I'm sure that they were ready to ask a lot more out of him with that outfield configuration. But that might be an element to this where it's like, we need to give Bo sort of a day off his feet, and the way that we're constructed right now, that means that Jonathan Clase needs to sit. Unfortunate and frankly a little avoidable, Blake, but that's kind of what I can come up with that, you know, kind of begins to explain it. But yeah, I do expect us to see a lot more of Clase with 3 lefties on the docket for the A series.
Well, here's one other interesting note, and I only mentioned this to promote something on the show on Friday. David Schneider's going to join us on Friday. He is down with the Buffalo Bisons right now, and I bring him up just briefly before we take a break, because they are facing a bunch of lefties this weekend, and obviously he started the season as a guy you thought would maybe be a right-handed bench bat who'd start against some lefties and come in as a pinch hitter. He obviously didn't play particularly well. He didn't have a great 2024. Didn't have a great start to his AAA Buffalo season, but .867 OPS over his last 15 games down at AAA Buffalo. He had won a player of the week. He had 3 hits yesterday, and most interesting, for really the first time, he played a couple games there last year. He's getting some reps at third base now.
Yeah, that's different.
Yeah, and Leo Giménez is back now after starting the season on the IL for a long stretch with mono. So there's a bit of an infielder glut going on there. But yeah, it caught my attention that he's played a couple games at third base right ahead of they've got a bunch of lefties coming up, and Ernie Clement is having to play second base pretty much every day with Giménez still down. Giménez hasn't even started a rehab assignment yet. So if you're looking at this Oakland series and how you get an extra righty bat in the lineup, we all still want to see lots of Addison Barger, but 3 lefty starters in 4 days, maybe there's a roster move.
Maybe there is a roster move, and, you know, I think that it's time. If he's hitting well, Blake, and he needed that reset, I don't think anyone will disagree with that at this point. But Davis Schneider can be a difference maker, and he can be a guy who sort of adds power, home runs to a lineup. He has been that for the Blue Jays in the past. That is what his profile says about him, and that's kind of what the Blue Jays need right now. I'm not saying that he's going to be the savior like he was a couple years ago, but
that Red Sox series was real fun.
It was, and it was kind of out of the blue, and it helped the Blue Jays make the playoffs. Legitimately, it did. So I don't know. I don't expect that again. I think that was his peak, but he can still be a guy who instills some power here.
Yeah. So anyway, caught my eye.
Yeah, this I gotta see though.
Yeah, you know, like you have Michael Stefanik on the roster, but he's probably not a guy you want to start three times in four games over the course of a series. So interesting there. If he doesn't get called up, David Schneider will be on the show Friday. We could talk to him about the changes he's made and how things have turned the corner for that Buffalo Bisons team. Alan Roden had three hits yesterday too. Is pretty locked in since going down there. He'd be in the mix too, although of course he is a left-handed hitter, so maybe not the series for him. A lot of good stuff down on the farm yesterday, including three hits from Arjun Namala. Again, we'll talk to Jonah Bierenbaum about him, about that as well. But right now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll go to ESPN's Paul Hembekidis, who is on Get Up on Baseball Tonight. Stats guy, loves his hoops too. My kind of guy. We'll talk to Hembo next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL.
The J.D. Bunkin Podcast.
Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. The Blue Jays get shut out 2-0. They have scored just four runs over the last five games. That's not a lot of runs.
It's a depressing first segment, but you know what? We did it together.
Yeah. Depressing and nerdy. I managed to, that's the Blake Murphy sweet spot right there. That's when I'm in the pocket. Yeah. We got another one tonight. It'll be Paxton Schultz, by the way, leading a pseudo bullpen day for the Toronto Blue Jays. We thought maybe it would be Eric Lauer. That's if you are a fantasy player or looking on StatCast or things like that. That is who is listed as the starter. The Blue Jays still have a TBD on their website officially, but we got told after the game last night that Paxton Schultz is going to get that start. I would imagine Eric Lauer is a big part of it. Similar to what we talked about with the Mariners game where it was Reyna or Lauer. This is probably to do with opponent lineup construction, where Lauer got the Seattle start because they were pretty lefty heavy and you want to maybe get some of their better hitters out of the game or at least coming off the bench. In this case, the Rangers skew pretty righty heavy. So start a righty, go once through the order if you can, hopefully once through the order with Paxton Schultz, and then maybe hand it over to Eric Lauer and see how the rest of the bullpen shakes out from there.
Tough to predict or even know what to expect from Paxton Schultz. He had that one extremely great outing, and then it's kind of been meh, but he is who the Blue Jays have right now.
Yeah, record-setting debut in terms of strikeouts out of the bullpen and swing and miss and things like that. So he should be pretty fresh for this one. They've gotten 11 innings out of him over four games. He's been working in a long relief role at AAA, not actually, this will be his first start of the season at any level, but we'll see if they can get, I think the hope is probably once through the order, and then you turn some of the Rangers around. We'll see how it goes. The more important thing maybe than the pitching is that you'll have to score more than zero runs to win the game. That has not been a problem for the top teams in the National League. Let's talk to Paul Hembekidis about it, of ESPN, of Baseball Tonight, of Get Up. He joins us now. Hembo, how you doing, man?
Hey, friends. It's always great to be on with you guys. You do a fabulous show. Always enjoy talking ball with you.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. And may we call you Hembo? Is that okay?
I didn't even ask permission. Yeah.
Fantastic.
The corporate nickname is in play here. It's in fair territory for us.
Amazing. Listen, Hembo, we've spoken about the Blue Jays a little bit too extensively for my taste with the way that the game went yesterday. So I wanted to start on a more positive note in that to me at least, is always Shohei Ohtani. My God, I love watching that man play baseball.
And listening, the sound of the bat crack when it's he amazing. Hits some of those 440-footers.
20th home run of the season, I believe it was yesterday, right? Yeah, it's been awesome to see him. And now he's also facing live hitters. It seems like he is, you know, inching forward here in his pitching return. What have you made of his season, and how much do the Dodgers need another pitcher right now, especially an Ohtani caliber pitcher?
Well, as a hitter, we've seen this before, but very rarely. I mean, he's leading off as their designated hitter, leading the major leagues in home runs. I mean, he's on pace for 60 home runs this season, and he's probably going to steal 30-plus bases along the way. I'd probably bet on something like a 50-25, 50-30 type season for him, which, of course, is just astonishing when considering the fact that he's going to be a starting pitcher for the second half of this season, which no longer is a luxury for the Dodgers. It is, to be exceedingly clear, a necessity, because it's a starting rotation that is an absolute shambles at the moment. Aside from Yamamoto, who's been terrific this year, a sub-2 ERA and 11 starts, the rest of the rotation has an ERA north of 5. In fact, if you were to remove Yamamoto's innings just for the purposes of the exercise, the Dodgers would have the number 28 starting rotation in baseball when it comes to ERA. So not only do they need Ohtani to be good. And if this team is going to have any real chance of repeating, I think it goes without saying that their starting rotation is going to have to be a whole lot better and a whole lot healthier. I wouldn't necessarily bet on Ohtani being the kind of high volume pitcher that they necessarily need, but every sixth or seventh day, I could see him going 5 or 6 shutty, averaging 1 strikeout, you know, per inning, basically. And then if he continues to hit anything approximating this, he's obviously a shoe-in for the MVP award. But coming into a season in which we thought the Dodgers were inevitable, they have been far from that after their 8-0 start. But Ohtani is obviously more than keeping up his end of the bargain, as is the rest of the lineup. But at this point, we're not seeing much of Glasnow. We've not seen much of Snell. Sasaki's been awful, candidly. Mm-hmm. And so they actually need Shohei Ohtani to start for them and shove after the All-Star break.
Yeah, it's a lot of Ben Kasperius, and he's been good. But, like, this is the Tyler Holton impression of today you're a closer, today you're a bulk guy, today you're a starter, is very difficult to pull off, I'd imagine, if you're Kasperius or anyone. So, yeah, that aspect of it will be fascinating. What do you – like, obviously the injury stuff is not – it's not entirely in their control, and I think when you're a big budget team, it's part of the strategy in that they can embrace risk a little bit more because they have the budget to try to address it and things like that. But the fact that the couple of prospects that they were hoping could fill out that that rotation in a pinch, in a Landon Knack, in a Bobby Miller, that those guys haven't broken through and haven't been effective. What do you make of that aspect of it? Because the Dodgers for a long time were this high budget team who went out and spent and traded for a lot of guys, but they were also doing a pretty good job on the development side. And that hasn't seemed to keep up on the pitching part.
Yeah. It's a fascinating observation that you make. The genius of the Dodgers and the reason why having that large a payroll is so disproportionately advantageous isn't just because it provides you the opportunity to sign basically whomever you want, but it provides you the opportunity to absorb major injuries and underperformance and still be okay. Most any other club couldn't do that. The Rockies signed Chris Bryant to a $180 million contract. If he's not phenomenal, you can't win. There are any number of teams for whom you can use that as an example. Anthony Rendon, he stinks, thus the Angels stink. But in the Dodgers' case, Blake Snell's hurt. Tyler Glasnow's hurt. Michael Conforto's not hitting, etc. And it doesn't much matter, at least as it relates to their postseason chase, because they're so deep, because they can basically outspend their own inefficiencies, their own shortcomings. That ultimately is sort of where they land. They certainly haven't done as good a job lately at bringing up those arms and them shoving in the major leagues, which of course is something that I suppose if you're a fan of theirs, you can nitpick. But ultimately, this team's going to win 100 games or close to it, and they're probably going to be the favorite to win the National League until they either do or don't in the postseason. So these are certainly the sort of what we call first world problems, obviously, from the perspective of their ridiculous payroll. But it's a good observation that you make that the Dodgers have not done nearly as good a job as they have in the past of bringing up pitchers and allowing them to perform. We saw Dustin May stink yesterday too. So this is something that they're dealing with right now, and they're going to have to outspend and out-hit their way out of all their pitching shortcomings so far.
Well, it sounds like that is what the trade deadline is for, right? As we trudge towards June here. But is this something that we should probably expect from the Dodgers here? Are they going to be aggressive on the market, in your opinion?
Yes. In fact, the fact that they're not just running away with the National League West indicates to me that they are very likely to go for the gusto. I wouldn't be at all surprised if you see the Dodgers call your favorite team, the Toronto Blue Jays, and ask about Bo Bichette. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Bo Bichette was the Dodgers starting shortstop on August 1st this season, and that's because it's a fairly obvious fit. If the starting pitching market is, we'll call, too expensive for their liking, perhaps they decide that they want to index and use Blake Snell and Tyler Glasnow when they come back, and they're going to stay in-house because, of course, all their stuff right now is injury-based and not largely performance-based, at least. I could see them trading for a shortstop. I could see them making trade deadline moves and actually erring on the side of, let's bring in position players. Because that's how they won the championship last year. Let's remember, they didn't pitch all that well last season either, but they had literally an all-time great lineup that absolutely mashed the baseball throughout October. And when you add Ohtani to the rotation, I think they're going to look to just add talent at the trade deadline and not necessarily specify where that talent goes based upon where the market leads them.
Yes, time to start researching Jose DePaula if you are a seller around baseball. One more Dodgers one for you, Paul, before we move on here. You mentioned that they're going to have to try to hit their way out of this. And obviously, in the postseason last year, Freddie Freeman was a monster part of that. And he was doing it hurt. And it was this really cool thing because he was already 35 at that point. And, you know, you start to think about legacy and things like that. And then he comes out this year and he is having arguably the best offensive start to a season in his career. What have you made of Freeman sitting here hitting .356 at the end of May?
I can't believe how good that guy is. But we know that it takes him an hour every game just to get on the field because his ankle is still in such rough shape from that offseason surgery. Freddie Freeman is one of the few players in baseball for whom you could say that guy could hit with his eyes closed. He is a first ballot Hall of Famer in the making who is demonstrably better in his 30s than his 20s. He is the ultimate unicorn. There are so few of those players sprinkled in baseball history. Off the top of my head, you would say that Edgar Martinez was like that. Adrian Beltre was like that. Perhaps a few others. You know, Honus Wagner was another player who was phenomenal in his 30s after merely being great in his 20s. But the thing about Freddie Freeman is that he has the kind of replicable swing and absurd hand-eye coordination that's going to enable him to hit forever. He doesn't have any skills that you would say are not old man skills. And as his swing decisions continue to improve, as he continues to age, Freddie Freeman's going to hit like this or some approximation of this through his 30s, and he's going to have a chance to approach, if not exceed, 3,000 hits, and he might be the last guy to ever do it. I'm amazed. I'm amazed at what he did in the postseason last year, amazed at what he's doing right now. He just has this innate ability to put baseball on the barrel the way that so few players ever have, and some of the all-time greats like Carew and Gwynn and players like that. To me, he's more along those lines than he is some of the all-time great sluggers that have played first base. But Freddie Freeman is trending towards being a top 100 player of all time who somehow still finds himself at 35, smack dab in the middle of his prime.
Speaking of great sluggers, I wanted to talk to you or ask you about Kyle Schwarber,
mm-hmm.
who has been phenomenal this season, just hit his 300th career home run a little bit earlier this month. Steady power production, it seems like, over his 11 major league seasons. And again, a guy who just seems to keep getting better in finding new gears here, Hembo.
Yeah, the final point that you made is the best point that you made. I'm a Phillies fan, and I desperately want my team to sign him to an extension before free agency hits at the risk of losing him to somebody, because I think that somebody is a really smart somebody. I wrote down two reasons why. The first of which is I think his bat just remains so fast. It's 98th percentile bat speed or better in each of the last three seasons. This is someone with an elite contact profile and bat speed to match. And the second thing I wrote down is that he has demonstrated, like you said, the aptitude to improve in meaningful ways. This is the first year of his career with a sub-20 chase rate, the first year of his career with a sub-25 strikeout rate. And perhaps most impressively, he is slashing .301, .440, .753 this year against lefties. Kyle Schwarber's a lefty and slashing that against lefties. It's the highest OPS of any hitter in baseball this season with a platoon disadvantage. Aaron Judge against righties is second by that standard of measure. So this all adds up to an ascending player who I'm thinking the Phillies should extend midseason. I don't exactly know what that contract's going to look like, considering you're moving forward from the ages of 33 on, and he's almost exclusively a DH. But a player like that in today's climate, to me, is still super valuable, regardless of what the WAR says he's worth.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, too, the lefty-on-lefty stuff for a guy who, when he first came up in 2017-2018, people were kind of, yeah, maybe he's like the strong side of a platoon guy. Maybe he won't be a guy that's in there, you know, every single day. And then the last couple years has been, yeah, he's at least gotten to like league average against lefties. You don't have to take him out of the lineup. And now it's like, no, he absolutely crushes lefties. It's pretty fascinating. Do you have, I sorry to put you on the spot, because I know you have the stats handy, but do you have a sense of how he's been able to do that beyond just he's an exceptionally good hitter and is on a heater lefty on lefty?
Yeah, so he's operated with his B swing more effectively and more frequently. And when you're facing lefties and you're a lefty, all you can really use all that frequently is your B swing. Now, we still see him at absolute nukes off of lefties this season, so it's not to say that he doesn't ever max out his exit velocity or max out his bat speed. But just having watched all these at-bats, from having watched all these games and from having watched him play for 4 years in Philadelphia, he's staying closed a lot better. He's done a really good job with the Philly staff of figuring out how his body works and operates. And it's something that we rarely see. As you well know from having talked baseball for as long as you have, platoon splits are one of the stickiest things that you have to predict. Once you have a representative sample size, you can very effectively project what a player is going to do against same-sided or opposite-sided pitchers. We know exactly what Jock Peterson's going to do against righties and lefties. And Kyle Schwarber is 32 years old, at least in theory. That's something that we should know. But we have so much data science now and so many laboratories for which you can actually replicate what these reps look like. And his ability to stay closed against lefties and not bail on that breaking ball down and away, which was his bugaboo for the longest time, as it is many lefties, has enabled him to stay up the middle a lot more, which is a little bit cliche. But in his case, it's very true. Kyle Schwarber doesn't use the whole field necessarily. He does tap into his pull side very effectively, but he doesn't flail anymore. He stays through the middle of the field a lot more effectively. And he knows that he can use his B swing and still hit a home run. So he doesn't have to swing hard. He just has to swing quick. And there's a huge difference between the two.
Let's stick with left-handed hitters, but unfortunately talk about someone who hasn't performed anywhere near to the level that we expected. And that is Juan Soto.
Yeah. Well, hey, the bat speed's down. Maybe he needs to optimize the B swing a little bit more effectively too.
You know, I don't think anyone expects Juan Soto to struggle forever, but it has been pretty puzzling to see the way that his Mets tenure has started. What have you made of that up to this point, Hembo?
There's a lot to unpack here. Yeah. So a few things. It's obvious that he is in his own head. And the reason we know that for sure, or at least I believe that to be the case, is because he's so obviously pressing in high leverage. That's demonstrated with his numbers. When Juan Soto's up in low leverage, he's hitting like Juan Soto. He's hitting like he always has. But with each layer of leverage that you have add numerically, he is performing markedly worse, which is just like the most obvious I'm pressing statistic that you could possibly conjure. That being said, there are a few other frustrating elements of Juan Soto's game that Mets fans are experiencing right now. The two most obvious ones are he's starting games so slowly. He's always 0 for 1, in other words. And when you're always 0 for 1, you're swimming upstream the rest of the game. Nothing's better than getting a first inning knock and feeling like the rest of the game for him is house money. He's starting 0 for 1 constantly. I don't know if that's preparation on his behalf, the opposing pitchers, or some combination thereof. But his first inning numbers this year have been dreadful. And the second thing I wrote down is that he's just taking way too many pitches. Like, I know he's very takey, and that's kind of his thing. It's always going to be his thing. But he's taking too many meatballs. He's taking too many pitches in the heart of the zone. And pitchers are challenging him a lot more in the zone because they know that he's allowing them to get away with too many mistakes. I want to see him slug more. I want to see him swing more. And if that means he chases a little bit more, I'm good with it. But you're not often going to take your way out of a slump. You're not often going to walk your way out of a slump, at least not when you're a hitter as patient as Juan Soto is. I want to see him taking aggressive leverage count hacks, especially when he's being thrown pitches in the middle of the zone, especially early in the count. He's taking those pitches and trying to walk. I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't be trying to walk, but picking your spots, given the context of leverage and what's happening in the game and the count, and all these things are obviously very important. Juan Soto attacks these at-bats seemingly watching from afar. I'm a Phillies fan, not a Mets fan, but I obviously see a lot of his at-bats almost as if they're all the same, like he's in a batting cage. No. You need to pick your spots when the game calls for you to pick your spots. And right now, he's not really thinking about game. He's thinking about how can I walk in whatever moment the game calls for. And that's just no way a person should be hitting in the major leagues when pitchers are too good to attack you in the heart of the zone.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I think that the matchup against Garrett Crochet from a few weeks back is the one that comes to mind, right? He just stood there and watched three pitches in the zone. It's it's tough, and that's it doesn't necessarily translate to winning baseball.
Yeah, it's a very bizarre at bat. Yeah, very bizarre at bat. But just an odd couple of weeks for Juan Soto. You mentioned your Phillies guys, so you got a close look the other week at O'Neill Cruz, and he didn't do anything against your Phillies, but I know he's a guy that you've tweeted about. You're a numbers guy. The StatCast stuff is just crazy. 51 career home runs with an average exit velocity of over 110 miles an hour, which I believe you tweeted is tops in that we've ever tracked. And my question for you, I mean, you can just geek out about how cool it is to watch O'Neill Cruz if you want, but my question is more like, O'Neill Cruz has always been like the StatCast guy, the sprint speed, the arm strength, the exit velocity, and things like that. But this is the first year where reliably he's been above average at the plate and as an overall player. And I wonder, you know, the lesson in there or what your kind of patience level is with these kind of guys who are so toolsy, who have all the underlying results, but it takes a little bit for the actual production to come along.
I believe that on balance, we are too obsessed with what StatCast tell us and not obsessed enough with swing decisions. Now, StatCast can tell us what pitchers make, hitters make good and bad swing decisions and how frequently they do. But how hard you hit the baseball only matters so much, because if you don't hit the baseball often or you don't optimize when you do it and how you do it, it doesn't much matter. But right now, O'Neill Cruz owns a walk rate in the 97th percentile. Mm-hmm. And so you can live with a 30% whiff rate. You can live with a huge strikeout rate if you're walking that frequently, because it does demonstrate to me that his swing decisions are improving. He's swinging and missing a lot, but he's also in three ball counts a lot more shrewd with his takes. And that matters a lot. I have no issue with end zone whiff, with early count whiff. But if you're going to live in the 97th percentile in walk rate, you can get away with it. Like, to me, the ultimate indicator of whether or not you're swinging and missing too much isn't nearly that number in raw form or by itself. It's the relationship between your strikeout and your walk rate, the relationship between your swing and miss rate and your contact rate. And these things obviously have an interaction between the two that is a lot more complicated than whatever the StatCast slider show. The ratio, the difference between the two, your strikeouts and your walks, these are things that obviously much matter. We evaluate pitchers that way. Why don't we evaluate hitters more frequently that way? They're trying to get you out doing the same stuff. And so, yes, O'Neill Cruz, StatCast darling, hit a baseball 122. It was an absolute nuke. At the same time, what impresses me the most is the fact that for every 100 times he comes up to the plate this year, he's walking 16 of them. And that is the most encouraging number if I'm a fan of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Well, and that makes a lot of sense coming from a guy who had such a high walk rate at Cedarvale University. I dug up the stats. I know you could take a walk yourself back in your day.
Yes, if you go to my baseball reference page and you see all the 82-mile-per-hour slop I was hitting in Ohio in 2010, you can see that I walked a lot more than I struck out. But at the same time, I had no power. I mean, to call me a Punch and Judy would be a gross overstatement. For me to wind up on second base was a minor miracle. That was water into wine when it comes to my baseball career.
Before we let you go here, Hembo, I know you're a bit of a basketball guy too. Thunder and Pacers both up 3-1 here. Assuming they close out their respective series, who do you like in the finals?
Thunder and five. This team is way better than the public realize. They're going to run through the Indiana Pacers, kind of like the way that the Celtics ran through the Mavericks last year. But this was an all-time great regular season team. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander just had one of the top dozen or so MVP seasons of all time when considering volume and efficiency. I think they're very likely to close out Minnesota in game five, and they're going to run away with it. This is one of the most disruptive defenses in the history of the league, with a big three in Holmgren, Williams, and SGA that is not just like ascending, but it's good enough right now to be the trio to win the championship. They have every single attribute, every single ingredient, and they also have tremendous role definition, which is my favorite thing about that team. Everyone is a superstar in the context of their role. It's exactly the way that Celtics won last year. It's exactly the way that the Thunder are going to win this year. I'd be willing to bet you that they do not lose more than one game the remainder of the season en route to the championship.
Well, that's, I mean, hey, this is a Canadian show, and they've got Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Lou Dort. So as much as we love former Raptor Pascal Siakam, there will be no arguments here. Paul, thanks so much for doing this, man. Really appreciate it.
Later, friends.
Paul Hembekides, ESPN Get Up Baseball Tonight, also co-author of Got Your Numbers and Got Your Answers, a couple of fun sports trivia and for sports jersey number related books, great coffee table books with Mike Greenberg there. And yeah, we got we might have a wrap on that OKC Timberwolves series tonight. Sorry,
JD. Yeah,
sorry,
listen,
JD.
It's been a good one. I've enjoyed the NBA playoffs so far. I think that, and you know, as you know, my brother's an OKC fan, so
I didn't know that. I don't.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Well, he is. It gives me something to talk about with him. You know, like just yeah. I often take the Blake approach where he's like, "Hey, how are you doing?" And I go, "Not as good as your OKC, but I'm doing pretty well." And he seems to enjoy that. So
yeah. It's better than saying I'm depressed to your brother or to strangers on the show. All right. Speaking of depressed, let's take a break. We'll talk to Jonah Birenbaum of The Score on the other side. We will talk a little bit more about the Blue Jays struggling on offense, but we're also going to highlight that strong Bowden Francis start from yesterday. Hopefully a step forward, at least in terms of his fastball usage and the effectiveness of that pitch. That is next as Jay Stock Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. We talked in the opening segment about the zero in the Jays' 2-0 loss to the Texas Rangers yesterday. I don't really want to talk about the two and Chad Green and Alejandro Kirk's throwing error on a set back pick play down to third base. So let's talk about the zero that was.
Yes.
Until it got to that point. We are joined by another zero, Jonah Birenbaum of The Score. You know him at Birenball on Twitter. What's up, buddy?
You know what's amazing is that's probably the most flattering introduction you've ever given me. So it's an honor and a privilege to join you both once again.
Yeah, Julia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for joining. I'm so sorry. I just want you to know that his words do not represent my thoughts.
Yeah.
Thank you. No, it's just my life, so it's fine.
Yeah. You haven't done a segment with Jonah yet. Jonah, buddy, we got a lot. You and I were texting, of course, as we do during most games, pulling our hair out. But let's start with the positive. There was a positive in that game, even a 2-0 loss, and it was Bowden Francis, for the first time this year, putting up a goose egg. He allowed zero runs through five and change innings. The only the second time in his last seven starts he's even got out of the fifth inning. So some progress there. What'd you see in what Bowden Francis was able to do yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, that was just what the doctor ordered for Bowden Francis. His last time out was arguably the nadir of his season. It wasn't his worst start of the year. That was the five-homer game against Boston. But the fact that he got removed after four innings and only two runs allowed and 77 pitches, I think it really evinced how little confidence John Schneider has in him right now. So it was great to see him come out last night and really cruise like he did. Five-plus shutout frames, only five hard hit balls, only five balls with an expected batting average above 170. And he did it in a really interesting way. 68% fastballs last night, which is his highest fastball rate of the season. And that approach made sense for a couple reasons. One, he had a great heater last night. He was commanding it well, and he was throwing it harder on average than he has in any previous start this year. He actually threw his hardest pitch of the season last night. But also, his secondary offerings have not been particularly good this year, and his splitter, which is his go-to secondary pitch, has been especially vulnerable. He's already given up five homers on his splitter this season. That's five more than he allowed on it a year ago. And so he used it relatively sparingly last night, just 17% of the time, which is notably down from his season rate of 23%. So I think last night was a really good case of Francis leaning into his greatest strength, which is his fastball, and using it to great success. Now, I will caution, that was not a good Rangers lineup. There's no Corey Seager. There was no Jock Peterson or Evan Carter, who, granted, have gotten off to rough starts this year. And both Marcus Semien and Adolis Garcia have fallen off big time. So I don't think that this approach can necessarily work every time out. And again, while it is his strength, his fastball isn't an elite pitch. It doesn't have elite velocity or elite induced vertical break. By Stuff Plus, it's tied for like the 54th best fastball among pitchers with at least 40 innings pitched. But credit to Bowden Francis. He made it work last night. He turned in his best start of the year. And he gave the Blue Jays a chance to win.
He did. And with respect to the fastball, there's another component there in that that's a pretty big ballpark. And I know that we tend to associate the Texas Rangers with a hitter-friendly ballpark. But the last couple of years, especially with the roof closed, that park has played slightly below average for hitters. So if you're going to look at Bowden Francis's great stretch last year, where it was a no-hitter bid every time out, it was a lot of bad fly ball contact, you can get away with that a little bit more in Texas than maybe you're going to get away with at Steinbrenner Field or whatever they call where the Athletics are playing this time. So you mentioned the fastball usage way up. He did throw 10 curveballs and sliders, but only three of them were even in the zone. And the one that got pieced was the hardest hit ball that he gave up all day. I believe it was the Adelis Garcia single or the Y Langford single. So the other thing here, though, is that he was good and he was cruising. But you mentioned the John Schneider confidence level. Last time out, he didn't get a chance to go even this long, and they pulled him out in the 70s for pitches. This time he had a shutout going through five. He pitches to the first batter, the leadoff hitter, the third time through the order. And he is still in the 70s for pitches, and he's still been going. And it's a single. It's not the hardest hit single that's ever been hit.
Wasn't even a terrible, terrible pitch. No. It was an okay pitch there.
And the first sign, though, and maybe it was the case that he was only going to go until there was a base runner, but it's particularly notable when today you're going to have a game that's led by Paxton Schultz, likely with Eric Lauer and Jose Urena in the mix, that on a day that Bowden Francis looked more effective, the leash was still pretty short for a third time through the order. What do you make of that aspect of where, not just yesterday, but where Bowden Francis is moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a case of John Schneider trying to put him in a position to be successful. We know that the third time through the lineup, he's serving up an OPS north of 1,100. He just can't turn a lineup over for a second time. I know it's really an astounding figure. I thought that the Josh Smith single was so perfect. It was like, okay, third time through, hard hit ball. Let's get him out of here. We know what's coming. And look, I appreciate that they got something of a bullpen game coming today, but yesterday represented a really good chance to win a game, to win a series. And I think that John Schneider needs to be aggressive, knowing who Bowden Francis is and knowing that, you know, we don't necessarily have chances to win a ball game in the fifth every single night. Let's take advantage of this and deal with tomorrow when it comes.
I will say that the secondary stuff, I know that he didn't use it as often, Jonah, but even the split, it did look better this time around. And maybe it is a product of not using it as much and kind of just, you know, picking your spots a little bit more with it. Buck Martinez repeatedly on the broadcast is clamoring for Francis to throw a few more sliders. What did you make of the secondary stuff here? And is that also a step forward for Francis?
I don't know if it's a step forward necessarily. I thought that the shape of the splitter was decent last night. I thought the location was inconsistent. I thought he threw a bad one to Jake Berger that Berger missed. I think he threw a tough one to Higashioka that Higashioka missed. Even the one that he threw to, I think it was Osuna, maybe for strike three that was called, I didn't think it was in a great spot. So, you know, I think that what we saw last night in terms of the splitter command is pretty much consistent with what we've seen from his splitter so far this season. But, you know, when you're dotting with your fastball like that and getting ahead of guys and establishing count leverage, like, you have a little more margin for error, but would be nice to see the splitter getting down a little bit more and him commanding it a little more consistently to really maximize its utility.
The third time through the order thing is so interesting too. And obviously you mentioned the OPS over 1,100 for Bowden Francis third time through. I know some people like and dislike that. I actually broke down on Blue Jay Central last night. I broke something down. I didn't break down. I'll save that for later in this season on this show, me breaking down. But I broke down the trend in baseball where actually this is for the first time since 1973, starting pitcher ERA is better than relief pitcher ERA. And obviously a big component of that is starters are asked to do less. They're asked to go through the order a third time less frequently. So, you know, you don't have to. The question is no longer, is Chris Bassett's 121st pitch better than Paxton Schultz's first pitch? Is Chris Bassett's 91st pitch
99th pitch
better than Paxton Schultz's first pitch? And in pulling the data for this, I actually found that the third time through the order effect league-wide is the lowest it's ever been. The lowest it's been going back to 2002, which is all I pulled data for. But 741 is the league-wide OPS a third or fourth time through the order, which is pretty low. It's only marginally higher than the first two times through the order. There's obviously, Jonah, a big selection bias here in who's allowed to go through an order a third time and in what you're not going to allow Bowden Francis the third time through the order when he's getting hit all around the ballpark. You'd only do it if he's pitching well. So some selection bias, but it is interesting that he's had outsized problems with it at a time when league-wide, maybe we've hit that equilibrium point of, and I would argue as someone who likes starting pitchers going longer, we've probably like passed the point of we're we've leaned too far toward the over reliever usage. And this isn't really a comment or a question related to Bowden Francis, but I am curious as to your take when you hear that number, when you hear that starters are outperforming relievers now and the third time through the order effect has decreased. Have we gone a little bit too far?
Well, I think it's that starters are relievers now, right? Yeah. They're just maxing it out on every pitch. They're all sitting at 98 with their heaters. Like, the distinction is increasingly slim, and that applies to their role as well. Like, they're asked to go five and dive increasingly, unless you're in the 99th percentile, unless you're Tarek Skubal, who can throw 103 with your final pitch of a complete game shutout. You're not going to get that assignment because the math just shows that it makes more sense to turn it over to a guy who's fresh and sitting at 100 as opposed to a guy who's, you know, faced this lineup twice already and is now his stuff is diminished by 10%. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that league-wide, third time through, we're looking at a 750 OPS, it really makes Bowden Francis' struggles all the more striking. It's like, wow, this guy, you know, really, really struggles to deceive a lineup after he's faced them twice. But it also, I think, makes sense with given what his repertoire looks like. Like, he doesn't really have great secondary offerings. You know, if his splitter was a little bit more effective, you might see a pathway to him having more success a third time through. But, you know, by the third time through, they've seen the fastball. They've probably seen a splitter or two. And, you know, you're not going to get guys to chase or to get bad contact on a show-me curveball or a show-me slider the third time through. So it does align with his profile. But, yeah, you know, I applaud John Schneider for understanding who Bowden Francis is, for understanding the situation, and for making the call that he did. It was the right one.
Jonah, I appreciate that you're not ready to say that Bowden Francis is so back. You were, however, ready to say that George Springer was so back. And he was, right? First 37 games, he had a 921 OPS. Hasn't been the same since then. He has cooled off a little bit, although he was on base three times yesterday, including a double. Good sign for sure. But over his past 13 games, I have it here in the doc, courtesy of Blake Murphy, 445 OPS. Really, you know, a significant decline from where he was. So is he still so back? Can he come back again? What are we looking at here?
He was back until I gave him the kiss of death, you know? And Blake's familiar with that. I've given it to Blake countless times. But no, I spoke to George on the 14th, and since our conversation, he's like 4-for-35 with a 244 on base, slugging 200, and his OPS has tumbled from above 900 to just over 800. But I will say, to your point, Julia, last night was his best game in a while, 1-for-2 with a double, a walk, a hit by pitch, two hard hit balls, one at 100 off the bat, one at 103, and I think last night was a microcosm of how pitchers have been attacking him lately and also what he needs to do to be successful. So in May, what pitchers have done is they've basically just been absolutely bombarding him with spin, a ton of sliders. And, you know, coming into the season in April, I think, especially coming off the last couple seasons that George Springer had, pitchers were not treading as cautiously with George Springer, feeding him a lot of fastballs, particularly sinkers, a lot of fastballs 0-0, a lot of fastballs 2-0. That has not been the case in May. As he had that incredible April, pitchers are like, okay, maybe we got to adjust a little bit here, and they've been feeding him a lot of breaking balls, particularly a lot of sliders, which has been his kryptonite for the last couple seasons. And it's been effective, right? Over the last couple weeks, during the slide that you outlined, his contact quality has dropped off big time. He had average exit velocity of almost 93 miles an hour through the first 6 weeks of the season. That's dropped below 88 miles an hour since May 13th. And last night, however, I think outlined what he needs to do to adjust back, and that's really taking advantage of mistakes and pouncing on fastballs when he gets them. You know, that first pitch that he saw from Nathan Eovaldi last night, it was a cutter, but it was middle-middle, and he's like, okay, this is a mistake. I'm going to pounce on it. He swung out at the first pitch, hammered it into the gap. Then you saw in his next AB, first pitch curveball, lays off. Fourth AB, he gets a first pitch curve, lays off. But in his third at-bat against Sean Armstrong, he got a first pitch sinker once again, right on it, and he hammered it into the gap. It happened to get caught. But, you know, this is what I think George Springer needs to do in this new context of getting fed a really healthy amount of spin, is he needs to be ready to pounce on fastballs, whether that's 3-1 or whether that's 0-0. And I think what he did last night really was a good template for what he needs to continue doing to continue being successful.
That's pretty fascinating because, you know, we heard so many times about Schneider and Springer himself. All they want is for him to get his A swing off once every at bat and he should be okay. And you mentioned the quality of contact. That has to be a little bit harder to do when you are experiencing a bit of a different approach or game plan from pitchers as well, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it's harder to square up spin than it is to square up a heater, even when you're, you know, 35 years old. So, I think that he's doing a good job of recognizing, you know, when I can get my ace swing off. That's against heaters in the zone, and when I need to lay off. Like last night, I think he saw 6 breaking balls, and he didn't swing at a single one. I think he saw like 7 heaters, including that first pitch cutter from Eovaldi, and he swung at 4 of them. So I think the approach is there. It's just a matter of, you know, executing it consistently. But, you know, George is a veteran hitter. He's a smart hitter. He knows how pitchers are going to attack him, especially, you know, given the struggles he's had against spin and particularly against sliders the last couple seasons. So, you know, I have all the confidence in the world that he knows that, you know, the adjustment that he needs to make. It's just a matter of executing it consistently. And last night was a step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating thing. You mentioned he's 35 going on 36. And I think of, they're not similar hitter types necessarily, but I think of what Josh Donaldson's post-Blue Jay career looked like. And in terms of, you know, he had to, at one point, like really cheat to catch up with top-end velocity. And pitchers would challenge him with that more than they are George Springer. So it's interesting to see that, hey, he's getting more spin and more spin even in the zone because, you know, the chase isn't crazy high with George. In fact, he has the best chase rate of his career right now. Yeah. In terms of knowing what to lay off. Whereas, you know, I think typically when I think of a guy getting into his late 30s, it's like, well, he's probably going to get more hard stuff because it's harder to stick around on it. Maybe if you've made it to 36 in Major League Baseball, you have a better eye for spin or off speed. So it's fascinating to see it it go that way for him. So hopefully the process side of that means that better days are ahead. The process side has been okay team-wide, Jonah, with things like chase and swing and miss. They have the lowest strikeout rate in the league, the batting average in whatever, however you split it up, like even with runners in scoring position, league average, batting average. First inning, really good batting average. So it's not a strikeout issue. It's not a swing and miss issue. It's not a batting average issue. The team's inability to do big damage, to hit for slug in big situations like runners in scoring position and first inning with men on and things like that. I broke down some of the bat tracking stuff underneath this in the first segment, but what have you made of like the base components, the foundational pieces for the Blue Jays approach being there, but the ability to kind of take that leap, do damage, put up crooked numbers, still escaping them this far into the season?
I think this is just the reality when you don't hit home runs. When you don't hit home runs, you're at the mercy of sequencing necessarily, and sequencing is notoriously fickle. And you'll go through stretches like the one the Blue Jays are in right now where you can't buy a hit with runners in scoring position and where all of your singles and your one nightly double happen with the bases empty or a runner on first base. It's pretty impressive, though, I will say. 4 runs over a 5-game span. The last time they did that, I wasn't even alive. It was August of 1990. So that's impressive even for this team. Meanwhile, going 3-for-36 with runners in scoring position dating back to that series opener in Friday. Look, it's frustrating and it must be absolutely maddening for the team's pitchers, but you know, there really isn't a solution here. The process isn't unsound and there's no lineup tweak that's going to magically solve their WHIP woes. This isn't a lineup construction issue. It's a roster construction issue. And with so little power in the lineup, this is the Blue Jays' fate. They're going to be streaky. And when it's all said and done, they're going to be a below average offensive team like they were last year. And I will say, if this team, look, because it hasn't meaningfully hamstrung them in a playoff chase perspective, they're only 3 games back of the third wild card. But if this team does end up making it to the playoffs, it won't be because they're constantly bludgeoning teams a la the 2015 Blue Jays. It'll be because, you know, the American League is the American League in 2025.
So the 2015 Blue Jays are such an interesting comp. And I've said this on the show before that not all 500-ish teams are created equal. And that Blue Jays team in 2015 was obviously better than that. They also were like, just in case, here are a bunch of reinforcements. You're going to have the most fun summer in the city that you can have since 1993. But when you look at, especially this year, you just mentioned the AL in 2025, there are a lot of teams right around 500, and some of them have better records than the Blue Jays, but play in the Central. Some of them have worse records than the Blue Jays, but we'd expect them to be better. This far into the season, we're a third of the way in. It's late May. How do you personally try to suss out what a team that is 500 and has upward mobility is, a team that is 500 and doesn't have upward mobility is? What are you looking at?
I mean, much like Alex Anthopoulos, you know, first and foremost, I'm looking at the run differential because we know that that's a better measure of team quality and a better predictor of future record than the team's current record. Wins aren't a function of previous wins. They're a function of runs scored and runs allowed. So it's more instructive when trying to suss out how good a team actually is to look at how well they do at those things. And yeah, when you're looking at a 50-game sample, you know, you should take into account strength of schedule and clock, where any crazy lopsided games might be skewing it. But generally speaking, I trust run differential. I trust base runs, which is based off of expected runs scored and expected runs allowed. But then beyond that, you also just look at the constituent elements of the team. Like the 2015 Blue Jays, even when they were hovering around 500 in the first half of the season, they still had by far the best offense in baseball. It wasn't even close. By WRC+, plus, by runs scored, they were miles ahead of every other team. It just, you know, sometimes 81 games can be too small of a sample to actually allow the best teams to distinguish themselves and the worst teams to distinguish themselves. So, yeah, I mean, in the case of the 2025 Blue Jays, that's not necessarily going to frame them through the most rosy lens because their run differential was minus 28. And, you know, I don't have the same confidence in them that I would have had in the 2015 Blue Jays, who were scoring 8 runs a night but were somehow finding ways to lose games. So, yeah, I mean, you look at the run differential, you look at the various components, and, you know, I think it's tough. I think a lot of people want to look at the record and point at the record and be like, hey, this is the only thing that matters. But, you know, if you dig a little deeper underneath the hood, you can find some more illuminating stuff.
Yeah, the sample size point is such a good one because it did seem like the Blue Jays were turning a corner a little bit offensively. We did get a little bit of that, and it gave a lot of people hope, and I would include myself in that. You know, it seems like as so much was talked about the process and sticking with it and not, you know, straying too far, not pressing, all of that, and the results weren't coming. And then when they started to come, a lot of people started sounding a lot smarter than they were at the beginning of the season. But here we are again, and I think that the most unfortunate part about this iteration of the Blue Jays is that things have not clicked at the same time, right? Well, the offense is rolling, the pitching is bad, and vice versa.
And it's tough, too, like the offensive side specifically, the run scoring, is like even when some of the indicators in the small sample of this season say maybe better days are ahead, most of these guys were also on the roster last year, and we have the sample of last year that, no,
that's
it didn't.
The problem.
And maybe 50 games isn't enough sample. Maybe if you're like really down the rabbit hole with sample size and stabilization, 162 games is a sample, but I would be very certain like 215 games is is a good sample. You go back to the tail end of 2023, so it's that part of it is tough to kind of sift through as
it
well.
Is.
I
yeah,
find.
It is. And go ahead,
Julia. Please.
No, listen, this was more or less a transition to talk about the pitching side of things and to talk about Kevin Gausman specifically, who was not the Kevin Gausman that we've come to know and love through a portion of the season there, seems to have really rediscovered his splitter, which is moving the way it's supposed to move vertically. He spoke about mechanical adjustments and all of that. But what do you make of the renaissance of the Kevin Gausman splitter there?
It's huge, and especially as the identity of this team becomes increasingly run prevention focused. I mean, not that it wasn't before, but, you know, just given how the offense is struggling. Yeah, it's absolutely massive, and in his last time out, he had more average vertical drop on his splitter than he's had in any start since 2021. You know, that's absolutely what you want to see, because it was looking like, you know, Kevin Gausman was transitioning into the decline phase of his career and wasn't necessarily going to be a top-of-the-rotation arm. But what we've seen the last couple starts with the swing and miss, with the fastball command, and certainly with the action on his splitter, it really seems like he is back to being close to the version that he was in his first couple years with the Blue Jays. And yeah, like I said, that, you know, that's an absolutely massive development for a team that's really, really struggling to score runs. And I just want to say, for the record, if they win today, I'm back. They're back. You know, if they win and Houston or Cleveland loses and they're 2 games back of the third wild card, of course they're back. But that's more a function of the playoff landscape, the playoff ecosystem in a 3 wild card world than it is an endorsement of this Blue Jays team. But yeah, it definitely, you know, every day we're riding the roller coaster.
Imagine if you were covering a National League team and you would be buried at this point.
Can't imagine.
Already. Jonah, looking ahead not to today's win, but some wins that are coming potentially in like 2028. You had a sit down with Arjun Namala, the top prospect in the Blue Jays system, who leads the entire organization with 9 home runs at the minor league level. He had 3 hits again yesterday. He started the season as the youngest player in the entire Northwest League. How was your chat with Arjun Namala from a get to know him perspective? And if it's not giving anything away, may you have more of those coming in the near future with Blue Jays prospects?
I may or may not have some interviews lined up with some highly touted prospects who may or may not now be with Northwest League Vancouver. We'll see. We'll see. No, it was great to chat with him and tremendous poise from a 19-year-old. Like, he really does seem to have, like, star quality. And I think he really understands kind of his role within the Blue Jays kind of world. I think he recognizes that he's a guy that is going to be very important to this franchise, and so he's just incredibly accommodating and incredibly patient and really indulges. I know a ton of media requests, not just from myself, but from everyone. And you know, if I get the blame for cursing George Springer, I need the credit for blessing Arjun Namala, because I think the day after I spoke with him, he went like 3 for 3 with a bomb and a triple, and he's generally been on an incredible heater since we chatted. But no, I mean, you can't say enough about what he's doing right now against older competition. He's like a top 12 hitter in the Northwest League by WRC Plus. He's hitting for power. He's playing a good shortstop. It really feels like it's only a matter of time before he's called up to New Hampshire, to Double A. You know, I don't think it's inconceivable that he could be there by the second half of this season. And yeah, I mean, for an organization that has really had very few player development triumphs in the last little while, what we're seeing so far from Arjun Namala and maybe from Treya Savage too is pretty amazing stuff.
One thing that stuck out to me about that conversation with Namala, and we can talk about other prospects in a little bit, but it was, you know, just how honest he was in saying that, listen, I don't model my game after anyone, but Francisco Lindor is a guy that I watch and that I train with in the off season and all of that. And I honestly, Jonah, can't think of a better guy to sort of follow in the footsteps here, not just for what he does on the field, but also the mentality, the maturity. That's got to help a young player starting out, a young shortstop specifically.
100%. Yeah, you really can't pick a better kind of archetype. You know, he does everything well, right? He's truly the epitome of a five-tool player. And, you know, what's interesting about Lindor, too, is that he's had moments in his career where he's been a little bit down, and he showed incredible resilience to bounce back from it, right? That first season in New York, he was getting booed in Queens because he wasn't performing up to the standard that Mets fans had expected after that incredible run that Lindor had with Cleveland. And now he's the most popular player in New York, well, at least in Flushing. So, yeah, I really can't think of a better guy to pick the brain of for Arjun Namala than a guy like Francisco Lindor, who's a perennial all-star, a five-tool player, one of the faces of the game, and potentially, who knows, maybe a Hall of Famer one day.
My favorite Lindor stat, 11 years in the league now, and despite occasional lows, he has never once finished a season with a batting line below league average. He has always been league average or better while playing a pretty premium shortstop. So yeah, Lindor, a good role model. I think the swing looks Mookie Betts. From a purely mechanical perspective, especially with the high follow-through and everything like that. A lot of fun to track Arjun Namala and Treya Savage. We'll keep an eye out for your next video feature, Jonah. A lot of fun to chat with you. Thanks for doing it, buddy.
Thanks for having me, guys. Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Jonah Berenbaum of The Score. Check him out at Berenball on Twitter. A lot of great video breakdowns over there. Not just baseball, football stuff too, as you prepare for fantasy football season in a month or so here. But yeah, a lot of great baseball stuff. Blue Jays and otherwise, the Namala chat was a lot of fun. Yeah, I hope the George Springer stuff turns around and we can revisit some of what was going well there. Right now, we're going to take a break.
Sounds good.
Then we are going to, we don't do power rankings ourselves on this show, but one of my favorite things to do is have a guest on who does power rankings. We don't have to do them, so we don't have to like put anything on the line. We got no stakes.
So you picked the Blue Jays 21st.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, let's pick at your power rankings. We'll take a break. We'll talk to Rowan Kavner on the other side of Fox Sports, and we'll get you set up for Game 3 of Rangers Blue Jays tonight. Tyler Molly against Paxton Schultz. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. 8:05 tonight will be Tyler Molly against Paxton Schultz. Or Paxton Schultz-led bullpen day. We'll see how it plays out. Paxton Schultz not listed as the Blue Jays' pleasant surprise on the pitching side. Rowan Kavner gave one to each team in Major League Baseball as he did his latest edition of the Power Rankings over at Fox Sports this week. He joins us now. Rowan, what's up, man? Good morning.
How you guys doing?
Doing well. Okay. I kind of teased it before you came on that you do the power rankings and we don't have to do them. We don't have to put anything out there. You run the risk of 29 fan bases being mad at you every time. I actually don't think, though, any Blue Jays fan is going to argue with you having them 21st. So quick snapshot, what is your read on this Blue Jays team from afar so far?
You know, it's not a disaster. It's not a disaster. It's just not, you're just waiting. You're like, okay, oh, you play really well against San Diego. Now maybe this is the time. It's a little run here. And then bam, you're just like back down to earth again. And it's hard to really kind of gain any sort of momentum with this team right now. You're waiting for it to kind of get going at some point. And it's hard to really rate them as a top half team right now. And you mentioned it, look, it power rankings can kind of be an excuse for the 29 fan bases that aren't ranked number one to get upset about it. You could make an argument for the Blue Jays really anywhere in that kind of 14 to 23 range, maybe, but it's hard to look at this team now and put them in the top half. You're still kind of looking for the power source offensively. The pitching's kind of just been up and down. And that's what you get. You get a team that's kind of hovering around 500 at that point.
Yeah. And listen, it was a spot up, I believe, right, from the last power ranking. So there's that. And also, it's not a disaster is probably the lead right now.
Number 21 with a bullet is not how the rankings usually spice that up. Yeah.
Look, the Vlad deal, too, I think takes some of the pressure off. Right. I mean, you come into the year and you think, what's going to happen with that? What's going to happen with that? You get that taken care of. And all of a sudden you can't hit home runs. You go, what's going on? Like, someone needs to hit home runs for this team. And that's still the case. He's got a few more than he did at the beginning, obviously. But yeah, that offense needs to get going. They need to find a power source. Varsho has been really fun to watch this year. But it just still feels kind of stuck in the mud.
Yeah, consistency has been particularly tough for the Blue Jays, which is why it is not surprising to see them where they are in the power rankings. I was, however, surprised to see the Detroit Tigers move from first to third. What went into that decision? I know that the Phillies have been playing tremendously well lately, but if you could just dig into that a little bit for us.
Yeah, it's just that. I mean, the Tigers have been an incredible story. I still think they've been, I would actually have them, and it's in there, the second best team in the American League. I think the Yankees have been awesome. You look at the run differential for them, they're at a +112. This year, it's not even close. They've played really, really good baseball. The Tigers have been super surprising. I wasn't a huge buyer last year when you saw that postseason run. It was, pitching chaos to kind of get them through October. I didn't think the offense had the pieces. They've completely changed my mind. I mean, that team is absolutely legit. This is more just when you're doing power rankings, especially every week, a lot of it is, how'd you do this last week? Who else has really made this huge jump? And you get these teams too, who maybe they go 3-3 in a week and they drop three or four spots. And everyone's like, what? It was a 500 week. It wasn't that bad. Yeah, well, another team went 5-1 or 6-0 and is now the best team in baseball. And if you look at the Phillies, a lot of that has to do, maybe with the teams they're playing, and you look at run differential and stuff like that. There's teams that have been better, but they've been really, really hot. I believe it was 21 of 27 games that they'd won. So this is more a thing that these other teams have just been a little bit better lately.
I also, not to speak for you, I have done power rankings in the past, and I just don't want to rank the teams in the same spot every week. It's an entertainment product. Yeah.
There's a world where if I wanted to just put the Dodgers first every week, and there's some places that do it, you could do that. And yeah, look, are they going to be number one in wins? No. And if you want to see the standings, there's a very easy way to see the standings. You can just go look up the standings if that's what you're looking for. This is kind of just a way to rank it. You could kind of make an argument for any of these teams, really in the top six. That's kind of the grouping, kind of ending it at, where kind of the Cubs, Dodgers, Mets are. You can make an argument for any of those teams number one. I've switched it up, from week to week. And this week it's the Phillies' turn, and next week it might not be. So
yeah,
we'll see.
It's a tough exercise for sure. It's it's a very different type of writing too. And I know that you write a lot of good features for Fox Sports as well. And in bringing up the Tigers, I also wanted to bring up the Spencer Torkelson feature that you wrote, in which basically you broke down how terrible his MLB start was, and just things that he did to sort of get back to who he is right now, which is honestly one of the top hitters in the game, right?
Yeah, it's huge. And he went into this year, you know, really on the brink. 2 years ago, he hits 31 homers. It wasn't maybe the start that anyone anticipated from a top overall pick, but he at least had the power numbers. And last year was a disaster. I mean, he spent almost half the year at AAA. He comes into this year really with no guaranteed roster spot. And you're talking about a top pick, you know, 5 years ago. And he had to earn it. And he completely kind of changed the way he swung. He went back to the way he was at, not just at Arizona State when he was, you know, the obvious top overall pick, but even just kind of growing up, he realized he had kind of started to get more upright in his stance. He wanted to catch up to the high fastball that was giving him problems. And he just got completely out of sorts. And he just said, I'm just going to kind of go back to the basics. He got off the plate. He went back in the plate. He got into a more athletic stance. It may not look as drastic as it sounds, but the changes are pretty big. He also looked at Mike Trout, who was one of his favorite players to watch forever. And he's always kind of had some trouble with high velocity. And he said, what am I doing changing everything to try to catch up to it? And the results of, it's hard to argue. He's been the best hitter for the most probably surprising team in baseball. One of the best offenses, definitely that surprising in baseball. And they just have a lot more pieces than I think we realize. I mean, they got Javi Baez playing center field and turning back the clock too. So he's definitely just been a part of it, but it's been a huge part of it.
This is not related to the power rankings because nobody cares about where the Angels are in the power rankings, even after that little bit of a heater that they were on. But it was interesting to sit down and read your Spencer Torkelson feature and then go back to your Logan Ohapi feature, because Logan Ohapi, around the same age, having a big step forward this year as well. Now, he was a little, you know, drafted a little earlier, a little later in the draft and things like that, a more typical kind of buildup. But that piece that you wrote on him was so fascinating in terms of even as a guy who got to the majors on a pretty normal path, had some success early on, the mental grind of trying to make it in baseball and how that wears on a guy and how that is such a big part. Like you mentioned Spencer Torkelson, hey, a challenge is, you know, the swing mechanics to get a high fastball. But then you read that Logan Ohapi piece and there's such a huge mental component as you develop as a major leaguer as well. What did you learn in kind of reporting that out and having Ohapi be so open with you about the mental side?
Yeah, he was great. He really likes talking about this stuff too. He's completely open. And it was actually, I was just sitting down talking to him about something completely different. And then I just kind of asked him about it. I mean, last August was brutal for him. The numbers, you can just go back and look. I think he'd under 100. And he was admitted. He was kind of just like worn down. And I think that can happen for catchers, especially in the second half. That's not abnormal. But it was the worst month of his professional life. It had kind of, it just wore on him kind of both mentally, physically. You know, he had heard from one of his coaches that, you know, go to the World Series. That might be fun. Just go see an environment of kind of like winning again and just try to kind of find that joy. And it's not that he didn't like baseball anymore. It's just when you're playing poorly and you're going there every day and you just can't figure it out, it's tough. And he got to, you know, he did turn it around late in the year. That kind of gave him a boost going into the offseason. He journals a lot. That's something that's always kind of been helpful for him since he got into the pro game. He kind of wanted to try to find a way to be more comfortable in uncomfortable situations. He was having like hard talks with family and friends because he thought, here are things I'm putting off. I want to feel uncomfortable. I want to be able to be more comfortable on and off the field. And he had to get away. And I think all of that combination just kind of refreshed him. And it kind of made him find the love for baseball again. He's been playing great. He's always had a ton of potential. And it's kind of all coming together for him this year. And there's going to be high strikeout rates and there's probably going to be ups and downs. And it's the same thing with Torkelson. You know, we're a third of the way through. They've handled it really well. I imagine there will probably be a downturn at some point. And kind of how do you handle that now? That's to be determined. But so far, so good for both of those guys.
Yeah, Ohapi is such an interesting, and that was a great, great piece of writing because he wants to be a leader in that clubhouse, right? And last year, it was so bizarre. It was a weird year for the Angels. We all know where they are and what they are right now. No Mike Trout. And that's got to wear on you too, right? If you're a 24, 25-year-old who wants to take up that that sort of leadership role, and good on him for actually doing it and stepping up. But at the same time, it does take a bit of a toll. And I find that, you know, the meditative practices, the journaling, we're seeing a bit more of that in the league right now. And it's helping guys in different ways, right?
Yeah, everyone needs some sort of, you know, whatever it is for your mental health or whatever it is to kind of get you back on track mentally, I think is a huge component of this. And everyone has, you know, different methods. And I mentioned kind of the, you know, the journaling part of this. I know he took up like cold tub plunges. He's like, I'm just doing anything I can that I don't like. I just need to kind of get my mind in that in that space again. And there's no doubt, like, Mike Trout's still the leader of that team. But I think you'll talk to anybody who's been there for a few years, and they all hear it. They all hear the jokes about the Angels, and it's frustrating for them. They want to be part of the change. And if you're a young guy who's part of that core, you can be that. Logan Ohapi's that. Zach Neto's been awesome. I don't know that anyone's talking enough about how good that dude is. Yeah. They have some guys, and so I think those guys want to be part of a different culture of Angels baseball than what you've heard so far. They got on a heater. It kind of went back down to earth. You lose a series to the Marlins, that's going to happen. So we'll see if they can kind of pull themselves back out and be maybe interesting down the stretch.
Yeah, it'll be, I'll tell you, they'll be trade deadline interesting at least. If Yoan Moncada, I'll keep lusting after him to be in the Jays lineup at some point. You mentioned kind of they know the jokes, they know the comments about the Angels, and it made me feel like a jerk for a second, because I have one about the Rockies in my doc, because you just did the power rankings and you were like, I'm gonna come up with one positive on the pitching side for every team, and in my notes I'm just like, good luck with the Rockies. I know Zach Agnos has been nice as a closer, but yeah, I kind of feel like a jerk about it now. But how hard was it to come up with those positives for a couple of those teams?
It's hard. But the one nice thing is at least I can start the power rankings and I know 30 and I know 29. Every week I can go 30, 29. I know Rockies, White Sox, although the White Sox have actually been, you know, playing better baseball. I know I think they're on an L3 right now. I say that as that happens, but that's easy. Yeah. I mean, look, if you're talking about anything, I decided to single up pitching. I try to keep it like do some sort of different theme every week, just mm-hmm. so it's not, this team's good. They won three in a row, you know. So I kind of just focused on pitching this time. And when you're a pitcher for the worst team ever in baseball, it's probably hard to find a whole lot of positives. But yeah, Zach Agnos, there you go.
All right, we'll spin it to a name that you highlighted in that piece. Is actually starting against the Blue Jays today in Tyler Mahle, 180 ERA. Probably especially important today after Nathan Eovaldi left yesterday, start against the Blue Jays after just two innings with a tricep soreness precaution there. What have you seen from Mahle and kind of this Rangers team in general, where they have three guys performing at an ace-like level, and they've had maybe even more trouble than the Blue Jays stringing offense together?
It's insane. And I know, like, I think we've talked about a lot of what are the surprises in baseball this year. We talked about the Tigers. I don't know if anyone expected the Rockies to be the worst team ever. What, you know, there's a lot of, you can go up and down the list here. The Rangers offense being this incompetent is shocking. And I think the big questions coming in were, you know, you have a lot of pitchers coming off injury. Obviously, DeGrom back, if he's healthy, there's a chance there. You bring back Eovaldi, you know, he's a really solid piece. I don't think anyone expected this from Mahle, another guy who had been injured. Solid pitcher, not this level of kind of elite that you've seen so far, but to have three guys who, and I don't know if he fell out this week, but you know, three guys within a top 10 in ERA for basically all season, the bullpen's been better than you expected. That, I mean, the pitching is not the problem. The offense has been awful. And to see Semien, I think he went down to 9 in the lineup lately. He hasn't been able to get going. Jock Peterson was a huge pickup. He hasn't been able to find anything and is now hurt there. They need to get healthy bats, but the guys that they're relying on need to be good too. I think Corey Seager's return should be important for them. I just keep waiting for them to sort of pick it up, and it's not happening. And we're not, you know, this isn't April anymore. We're at the end of May. We're a third of the way through the season. What you're seeing at some point has to be the real deal here, and it's hard to kind of find a way to get out of it. Wyatt Langford's awesome. You know, a healthy Josh Young could be helpful for them. I think they have the starting pitching, and it's a winnable division, but I'm concerned about a team's offense. I thought they might go back to the World Series this year. I am taking that back watching this offense.
Well, yes. They're expected to get Corey Seager back today, by the way. The reporting yesterday was that Seager could come off the aisle today. Say, so, hey, it's better than nothing. Maybe it's the shot in the arm.
Got to take what you can get. They need, you know, I think about, you know, Adolis Garcia, too, came into this year feeling healthy. He had worked on his knees. He was really banged up last season, and he, you know, he had big expectations. He was such a huge source of energy for that team during their World Series run. He hasn't really been able to get it going. That's, they need him. They need him to be kind of an energizer in the middle of the lineup.
Yeah, the parallels with the Blue Jays are, you know, they're right there, but there are some clear differences as well in that, yeah, they are expecting some help and some returns. And
they just won a World Series, colors that all.
Sure, so yeah. You can kind of do whatever at that point. Before we let you go, Ron, I just wanted to ask you one question about Chris Taylor, who was such a big part of the Los Angeles Dodgers for so long, released, obviously, not really playing to what anyone expected. And I know that this is, you know, a veteran guy, but and then he turns around, signs with the Angels. We're talking about, you know, veteran leadership and all of that. What did you think of that sequence of moves for Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a little bit of writing on the wall in terms of he's just had a hard time really producing for a team that's expected to go back to the World Series. And you can say the same thing with Austin Barnes. It's weird to go into that clubhouse and not see those two guys who are the two longest tenured position players on that team. And, you know, Barnes, as a backup catcher, you can maybe kind of get away with not having the offense. But this is a team that's now fighting in a division race. And I think they just got to a point where if you're not producing offensively, in the Barnes case, they had a top prospect in Dalton Rushing right behind him who was ready. I mean, really, the only problem was there was no spot. And for Taylor, you have, you know, Haesung Kim, they have, you know, kind of utility guys who have just been performing better. And at some point, you know, you have a long leash, and the Dodgers have been giving a lot of guys a long leash here to just, you know, the idea being we're waiting for the second half. It just almost feels like an exhibition for them in the first half. You can say that's a dangerous decision, but it kind of feels that way right now. But at some point, you got to produce, and they just haven't been able to produce offensively the way that you're used to seeing over the last 7, 8, 9 years.
Yeah, it's been an interesting one, and it's weird to see him in a different uniform. And also, like, you got signed and you were starting in center field against the Yankees like that. It was that part was awkward as well. Rowan, this has been great, man. Thanks so much for taking the time out, and again, great work on the Ohapi and Torkelson features.
Thanks so much, guys. Had a good time.
Rowan Kavner of Fox Sports. Yeah, make sure you go read those pieces. Spencer Torkelson has just been absolute heater, and then Ohapi, like, no one notices because it's the Angels, I think. Maybe during that 7-game win streak people notice, but like 30% above league average at the dish, and you're a catcher who plays the position pretty well back there,
and he's still young,
25.
He's still about to hit his prime, you know. This is good. I'm not saying that I predict the Angels to be good anytime soon, but it's definitely, there's Zach Neto is another huge positive for that team. And as you know from my past, I tend to follow the Angels a little bit more closely than other teams.
And I'll just never give up on Joe Adell. I'm not giving up on Yoan Moncada being a trade deadline bench addition, and I'll just never give up on Joe Adell turning into an actual guy. I would probably give up on the hope that Tyler Mahle is going to maintain a sub-2 ERA. He'll start against the Blue Jays tonight. He's always been pretty solid. Jays fans probably familiar with him, especially from his time with the Twins, but 60 innings this year of 11 starts and a 180 ERA. He strikes out fewer than 20% of the batters he faces. His walk rate isn't elite. His ground ball rate isn't elite. He's gotten, and I mentioned earlier that ballpark plays a little more pitcher friendly than we are historically used to with the Rangers. However, when only 3% of the fly balls you give up have left the park, you're skating on thin ice there. Right. You're dancing around some stuff. There's some smoke and mirrors going on with Mahle. That does not mean the Blue Jays are going to be the ones to regress him. That's A, not always how it works, and B, something you'd expect from an offense that's cooking a little bit better.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think you need to look at a 180 ERA here and be fearful or deferent of what Tyler Molly's doing. What he's doing, by the way, a 92-mile-an-hour fastball he'll lead with. They'll also go slider, splitter, cutter to righties, and just the splitter and cutter to lefties. Both the fastball and splitter have good results in terms of batting average and expected slugging and things like that, but none of his offerings are swing and miss pitches. So you kind of look at the things the Blue Jays do well, the things that Mahle allows you to do, probably a day with a lot of singles, and you hope you string them together, and you hope you don't pull your hair out if they don't get strung together in the proper sequences.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of done predicting what the Blue Jays are going to do offensively against any type of pitcher at this point. We just can't know, right, if they're going to be hot, if they're going to be cold, or what's going to happen. So good to know that the 180 ERA is not the be-all, end-all of it, but still, we'll see.
Yeah.
Where I'm at.
Shrug your shoulders. We'll see on the pitching side as well. Paxton Schultz is going to get the ball to lead a pseudo bullpen day. Again, he came up, he had this terrific first outing, tied a major league record for strikeouts in a relief outing that was a major league debut. He's been solid, not spectacular at AAA, but strikes out a lot of guys, doesn't have a super high walk rate, allows a lot of fly balls. So again, maybe you can get away with it today. We'll see what the heat is like and if the dome is closed and things like that. But he'll get some soft contact in the air. And then just as important, because you're probably only asking Paxton Schultz at most to go through the order once, Eric Lauer is available. He threw 85 pitches on Friday, so this would be on turn for him if he were starting. Jose Urena hasn't been used since Friday as well. Braden Frisser hasn't been used since Friday. So you have a number of guys. Brendan Little hasn't been used even longer than that, which is probably a positive given the rate he was being used at there. So you've got a fairly fresh bullpen. Only Yariel Rodriguez and Chad Green threw yesterday. Only Jeff Hoffman threw on Monday because of the Kevin Gausman stellar outing. So as far as bullpen days go, you're in okay shape for having a lot of options. Those are not Jeff Hoffman, Jimmy Garcia, Brendan Little, three innings each options, but we'll see if the Blue Jays can cobble it together. Thanks to Jonah Bierenbaum, Paul Hambakidis, and Rowan Kavner for joining us. Thanks to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blair and Barker will have you 4 to 6. And for Jays Talk postgame, we will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it all down for you. Julia, have a wonderful Wednesday.
Happy New Year.